So I'm going to spend the next few minutes talking about where to go, next steps. Because, you know, while the pandemic may come in the next 30, 40, 60, or 80 years, and we've learned maybe some lessons, but practically speaking, what can we do to act on those lessons and move forward from a policy standpoint? As you know from from a lot of events, we accumulate literature, academic literature, but not a lot gets done from a policy perspective. So it was interesting, start with a disclosure, no disclosures, that I'm going to try to tie in a document called the National Health Security Strategy document. That's a national federal document that's come along in the last few months, which national health security, because this was a pandemic, this was a national emergency, as was declared by the president, you all know, and this document defines national health security as a state in which the nation and its people are prepared for, protected from, and resilient in the face of health threats or incidents with potentially negative health consequences. So this is a statement coming directly from the document. This is a statement from Secretary Kathleen Sebelius in December of 2009, which basically states it's a part of that NHHS document that vision for health security described is built on foundation of community resilience. Okay. The healthy individuals, families, and communities with access to health care and with the knowledge and resources to know what to do to care for themselves and others in both routine and emergency situations. And community resilience is not possible without strong and sustainable public health, healthcare, and emergency response systems. So we're sort of in a period now that whether we are a resilient community across the country or we're not. And this document defined two chief goals of national strategy, which is to build community resilience and strengthen and sustain health and emergency response systems. So let's go back for a second to the flu seasons and what happened. And briefly, from October 2001 to March 6, 2010, this is the way CDC nationally tracks data for flu, which is called something called influenza-like illness. This is we have certain sentinel physicians in the community across the country and hospitals, and they are supposed to report number of people that come to their clinics or hospitals with cough, fever, sore throat, that sort of thing. So when you go up to them and have those complaints, they'll take care of you, but they'll also report it if they're one of those sentinel chosen physicians. And that data comes to us as local health departments, makes it to the state health department, and then makes it to the CDC. Here the jumbled up numbers are, the first four are this year, and the last two are the week. So January 1st starts the first week, and we go on until week 52. What you see as percent of ILI visits, that's how we track flu each year. At each year, somewhere between February, which is week 10 to week 20, March, is when a flu season peaks. Okay? It doesn't peak in October or November or December. Each year, flu peaks somewhere about February and March. Okay? That did not happen in 2009. This was the normal season for 2009. We should have known because it wasn't sort of peaking, but it doesn't peak each year that bad. But then it started October. It kept going on late October, November. That's when it's peaked with the pandemic. Okay, so this was an atypical year. How did we respond? And again, we are in Charleston, West Virginia. We're a smaller community, but we do have the largest local health department in the state. We developed a conceptual framework for action to the pandemic, which was based on that we have to include the scientific guidance of the experts, including research data, existing mitigation and strategy, and countermeasure delivery strategies. Then we've got to develop local community partnerships. And this framework was pre-NHSS document, so we were happy to see that document that sort of made sense to all this we were doing. Engage all stakeholders in the community. Develop resource sharing, risk communication strategies, and prepare. that leads to a lot of action that results in protected communities. We have more informed communities, more prepared communities. As a result, we achieve the ultimate goal, which is, you know, more illness prevention, less morbidity and mortality, means less people get sick and less people die. And as a result, you have less community disruption, which actually leads to more community resilience when it's over. We developed a multi-agency task force for H1N1, which had basically a steering committee and six subsections. We had education, special population, special needs, human protection that included folks like EMS, hospital, law enforcement, others, community and business relations, government relations, because those are also important, and healthcare. That included hospitals and providers. Part of the job of that healthcare committee was to develop more directed recommendations for vaccination in our community, in keeping the CDC recommendations in mind, but there was a lot of leeway in there. What's important here is we had a special marriage between healthcare and education, and that's where this talk is sort of going towards. Because when we did our research, so when we go back to the part about understand the existing research data in order to act, when we conducted our basic research, we found that mass vaccination of school-aged children may be the most efficient approach in reducing population-level influenza illness attack rates. Potential to substantially reduce the overall morbidity and mortality is there with school-located clinics, which are associated with influenza-related illness in a community. And modeling studies, actually, which we reviewed, showed that if more than 50% of kids were vaccinated, influenza burden could be significantly reduced in that community. So that's the data we had for us working at the time. We weren't seeing a lot of school-located clinics happening across the nation. But we saw that data. We saw the benefits as well as challenges of holding such clinics, and maybe it was more challenges that people weren't doing a lot of these clinics. The benefits, definitely, of holding such clinics are the following. There are a large number of children that can be covered in a very brief period of time. That does not happen when you tell your kids to take time off with, and parents to take time off and go sit in doctor's office just for the shot. It's a community-oriented effort, so we are addressing both trust and safety issues. They are very well addressed in a school location. School facilities are perfect for mass vaccination clinic as well as points of dispensing sites. Thinking about the anthrax model, schools are a great venue for having clinics where people can be dispensed a lot of prophylactic medications. School nurses and staff are great facilitators for communication as well as they have access to parents. And it encourages, this is the most important part here, partnership building. It encourages actually various healthcare, schools, other communities, parents to come together and talk to each other and do an activity around illness or illness prevention. The potential challenges that actually remain, and I emboldened the couple because that's still our big challenges, funding. Now, obviously, that wasn't a big deal in H1N1 because, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars were spent by federal government, but it is afterwards because there is no commitment on, you know, whether it's CDC or federal government to help communities develop those school-located clinics. Partnerships is a big challenge. Adequate staffing, that's another challenge. Disruption in educational activity, that's a question mark because some say it could happen, others say not really. Multiple schools, often communities and counties have multiple schools, so it becomes a very sort of nightmarish planning scenario. Handling and transporting of the vaccine is a big, and vaccine supply, of course, you know, some years we get plenty of supply, other years we don't. And that was certainly an issue in H1N1. So I'll briefly describe the school-located clinic process. Start with a lot of printing, a lot of papers. We have a school system of about 30,000 kids. We get volunteers. This is our United Way Day of Caring to come and stash all the packets that get ready to go to these 30,000 kids in schools. Here are the volunteers. We send Dear Parent letter to elementary and middle schools. Now, they're different because there are actually a different. Elementary schools in our area can get both either the shot or the nasal spray. Agreement was reached by us in the school system. They did not want nasal spray in their middle and high school because of question of unknown pregnancies in girls, so we decided not to have it, just a shot. But those are things that are decided by individual communities. But again, that should not derail the process. And the school superintendent and I, we signed together a letter, send them, and make it real short and pretty. And these are all documents available at a website that I can give later, and they can be downloaded if need to. Now, we have vaccine consent forms. There are two different types, whether it's a shot or the nasal form. Basic information, screening, insurance information, we capture that. It's totally voluntary. Don't mandate for anybody. Obviously, think about 2014 and think how that's going to change. And then VIS for both, we send them out. So that goes in the packet. That's what's in the packet. Obviously, the kids take it back to their home. We notify the school system packets are coming. We prepare our teams ready to go to give shots. Multiple teams discharge every day with a cold chain supply of vaccine while the school nurses are making sure and reviewing those forms. We have very clearly outlined MOUs with the school. We know who's doing what. And these are some of the next couple of slides. Communication and press and media work is very important. So we do all of this in the meanwhile, letting people know, communities know, whether it's television, radio, newspapers, that these are just from this year, this many articles, and some of them from H1N1. And the clinic process starts, and you know, we get people lined up, and these some more of these. So we do a very fair share to the point where people expect that this is going to happen. It's a good thing in the community. And so I'm going to give you some numbers now, and we could discuss in later on if you have questions specifically about the process, because it's a pretty lengthy process. It's taken us about 3 years to sort of get close to perfection. This is our 2009-10 H1N1 numbers. the first column you'll see the type of schools. We mixed up the private and public schools. We did not want to give people an excuse to say, well, they're doing public schools, not private. We mixed up all types of schools. Total number of students enrolled, as you can see here, number of students that got vaccinations. And what you see here is the vaccination rate. Now, I will show you some national numbers, and this was way higher than any of the national rates reported. So we achieved about 50% vaccination voluntary within our school system. Here is, as you recall, certain kids, were actually recommended to get two shots during the H1N1. And so two shots meant going back twice for those schools. That was mostly elementary schools, some daycares. And this is underreported. So we probably had higher rates here, but because back again here, this is, does not include the kids who may have just elected to go to their pediatricians and get the shots. Same thing here. What you see is these are the number of kids, and our second shot vaccination rate is about 62%. And that was also quite high for the number of, when you compare it with the state and national rates. And next slide will probably show you, well, the next one maybe. And we've done actually a study that we're working on right now. We looked at parents' beliefs towards safety of the vaccine in our community. What we found was this, about 63% said it was very safe, and about 35% said it was somewhat safe, and you can see how many said it was not safe at all. So because of the communication and letting people know and spreading that awareness, we really did not have a lot of parents that suspected had that anti-vaccine sort of mindset. Here's the illustration of comparison of the estimated the pandemic strain of vaccine, collected various datas end of January 2010, and here's the United States median rates for 6 months to 17 years, 36%, 37%. Here's for Region 3, because we belong to Region 3, that includes Delaware, D.C., Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and West Virginia. It's about 39%. For our state, West Virginia, it was about 47%. For our county, it was about 49%. So we thought we had such a good result and such a good sort of community buy-in, and you know, it's not every day that people like their health department. And this was one time when we had people saying, you know, that great job. So how can we build in? How can we sort of buy into their goodwill? And so we said, let's start a campaign each year. We'll go start going to schools and giving them shots. Well, the same issues came up. Partnership wasn't an issue, but a funding issue came up. We tried whether we go to state, to the feds, did not have any support. And maybe there were some legitimate reasons for it. So we said, you know, it's not a bad idea. Let's just develop a model where we can make it self-funded. So we did. And as I showed you, we asked people to voluntarily provide their insurance information from parents. But if nobody did, they did not provide it, we will not, tell their kids then they can't get the vaccination. However, we did let them know, you providing this goodwill gesture will factor in whether we conduct the campaign next year or not in the school. So if you value it, you will provide the information. So here's what happened, and I'll give you some of those numbers. For 2010-2011, obviously we've had a drop because it wasn't a pandemic going around. But still, for the rates following a pandemic year, this is what we have. Here's the number of enrollment, the number of vaccinations given, and obviously a lot more people were going to their pediatricians to get the vaccine. We still had about 27-28% kids who got their shots in the schools. So the question then becomes is this sustainable? That's the main question. And here are the number of insurances that we built. Okay. We received, if you add this up, about 91 or 92% of the people, the parents, actually volunteered the information, insurance information. And these are the sort of the split, and I don't have to go through each, but it was only 17%. We found out, actually, this was a great QI project because we realized 17% of the insurances that were filled in, we weren't billing them. So it gave us an opportunity to seek actually our ability to get those insurance covered for us so we can bill these next year. Only for 9%, no insurance information was provided. Here's the revenue. I'm going to give you the dollars and cents of it. We built about $112,000and $300. We received about $89,000. This is last year, and there's still money coming in. That's why it's to date. Here are the expenses. The vaccine expense, about $46,000. Staff, and I put that in green, the staff and supplies, because some of the staff, if they're not going out there, they're still at your health department. So if they're employees, you're still paying them. So we did have to hire some more staff, but a lot of the staff was still health department employed staff. That's a variable here. But overall, the cost, you can say it was about $71,000. So the net or range revenue, actually, there wasn't even a loss. So net profit actually was at least $18,000 and probably about $43,000. And we look at the, if you look at that, this was work done within 2 months. Okay? Not bad for a government local health department to actually come up with over $40,000 in a time when they're so difficult to generate revenue and have the partnerships and have the public's goodwill in a couple of months and reduce the morbidity and mortality in the community. And we're gathering some of that data already because we have a lot of anecdotal evidence that there has been a lot less influenza in our community. So we got the American Academy of Pediatrics of West Virginia to support it in writing our efforts. These are the results as well as strengths and weaknesses. We have different types of insurances billed. 91% of the parents volunteered insurance information. You could think about 2014 when everybody ought to have insurance, and we may make this mandatory to fill out the information at that point because there's no reason not to. It will only get better. No child was ever charged. 17% insurances were not billed, as I mentioned. Very, very positive community feedback. The memorandums of understandings and partnerships have led to several other projects, not just with the school systems, but with many others. Some of the tips here focus ought to be always on building partnerships and not necessarily a financial sort of way to go. Rely upon school system to provide a list of schools and schedule guidance. Clinics should mix private and public. Have to decide which grades to go first. That's up to your community. Have a process to address concerns, very important, and utilize vaccine as it becomes available. And some of the way forward is that they're fiscally feasible and sustainable as a best practice without state or federal funding. Expected to get much better, and several large townships and are already planning and calling us about this. And lastly, partnerships are important. Each member's responsibility and roles must be clear, and identify potential barriers so you can address them early. And learning from experiences is really, really important, and a lot of stuff I've already repeated. Here's our website. It's www.kchdwv.org. We have entire packets. Each year we put that up, and parents are obviously can download it, and anybody else can download and look at what the formats are. That's any questions? Yes. Sure. We have about, in the county, is about 200,000, and I think it's about 95% white, and we have about 96% white and 3%, I think, African Americans and 1% others. And income, I think about 40,000 is the average family income. And we have, as I showed you the slide, the amount of Medicaid that we did. We have about 15 to 20% Medicaid, I think, overall in the system. But yes, go ahead.
Did you have your school clinics during school hours or before school hours or after school hours? Because I think there's a big difference.
Right. We did it during school hours.
Yeah. Mornings or afternoons, did you have a specific?
We actually, what we do, at the peak, we dispense 14 teams at the same time to different schools. And what's important is to plan what time you're going to have it, and we have to be there at that time, whether it's the morning or day. But we leave a lot of that planning to the school nurses, actually, compared to us.
So you have school nurses in all your schools?
We have about 50 school nurses in over 100 schools. So school nurses are sort of stretched out, but they are actually charged with doing the planning. That's one of those things we've written down very clearly as a responsibility. You will provide us the schedule. We will provide you the staff to be there at that time. Yes, back.
I'm Martha Berger from the National Association of School Nurses. And what we heard from our members was that storage of the vaccine at the correct temperature was a real issue. How did you manage that?
The responsibility for all that is by the health department, not of the school. So what happens is we take the vaccine in the freezer with the cold chain maintained vaccine to each place, each school, each day. And we maintain it. And if we come short, we have a runner back and forth. It's the largest county in the state. However, we still do it. But we don't let the responsibility remains with the health department for a lot of other reasons other than just it's the right thing to do. Yes, sir.
How did you figure out which schools to go to first? I think when the vaccine came available, then the flu hit. So I think in our county, when we did it, the schools got picked last. Now we're really complaining.
I'll tell you, this is a little secret. But first of all, we let the school folks decide what schools they wanted to go to first. But the secret really is the school officials knew really the dirt in the community. They knew which schools were going to make the most fuss. So they knew where to go first. So, you know, the political keeping all that environment in play, check. Yes, sir.
So what's your legal challenge to run this kind of clinics?
Legal?
Yeah, and because I'm from Maine, and we try to run school clinic, and some concern like a liability issue, like this kind of thing.
Sure.
Have you met this kind of local concerns, school concerns?
The liability issue is this obviously is the health department or the school system. And once they both partner up, they're usually both covered by a good level of liability coverage, which is standard for both the school administration as well as the health departments. And if it's a partnership, obviously, that's why we have those MOUs to sort of say whose responsibility and all that. I'll give an example. We had a child that was given a vaccine once that actually parents had not consented for. You can consider that a liability issue, but when it came to, we addressed the issue, we investigated appropriately, we let the new media know that we're unhappy that while we were able to accommodate the 29,999,900 parents' wishes, we were not able to accommodate one child's parents' wishes. However, the good news here was the child was doing well, we checked into it, and we're happy, but we will try to improve it. That's the sort of response we come, we produce, so that legalities or issues are minimized. But otherwise, liability coverages of both the school system and the health department should be adequate to cover it. Yeah, go ahead.
Was this data sent to the state that you had for each student that was vaccinated? Did that information go to the state?
Yeah. This is all, we were required to, for the H1N1 pandemic, required to enter every shot into a state immunization registry. That's how we did it. Now, I don't know if we can get it back out, but that's what we put in. Yes, sir. Go ahead, and I'll ask you then.
Another question. Who billing you are doing this billing? Billing insurance company is very tedious.
And, right. And I think that's going to be one of the challenges with the local health departments across the country, because the way systems are moving now is health departments will have to bill for services, and some traditionally just haven't done it. We have done it traditionally, and that's why we continue to do it and actually pick up more insurances. So the answer is health departments bill, not the school system.
How? Manually or electronically?
It depends. So some of them, I don't mean to say that we fill out those pink forms to Medicare and send them on. We don't do that anymore. We build the information manually, but obviously it transmits electronically. We have electronic software that actually does the billing. Yes, sir. You had a question.
Did you require a written consent, or did the parent or legal guardian have to be there?
Yeah, we have, if you see the forms, and it's written consent, and right here, and then they have to sign right there. And it's a very exhaustive consent, and we've worked on it for the last 3 years right here. They have to sign, and they give all their allergy information, all that. And a nurse, again, goes over it again. If they have questions, they can always call the parent, because there's always a number there. Really not had any issues so far. Yes, ma'am. During the H1N1, we had extended evening clinics, and if the school, we said all pregnant women can also come, expecting mothers, and all, they can even bring their younger kids. So we accommodated them during the H1N1, which we're not doing again, but we did. Yeah.
So our statistics showed on different surveys that between 63% and 88% of school nurses were immunized or received the vaccine. I assume you had a similar high rate. However, among teachers, the number I'm seeing is around 39%. What was your number for teachers?
Do we have numbers?
We have our school nurses do their own vaccine.
Yeah. I can tell you what we do for our school teachers. I don't have the exact numbers with me, but I suspect it's quite high, because we purchase in bulk vaccine for the school system, and then we give them at the same price. So it doesn't cost school a lot, and school nurses vaccinate all the school staff. So that way, for the school teachers, it costs them nothing to get a shot, unless they're philosophically opposed to it. They end up getting the shot, actually, in school while at work.
So it's much easier for that school nurse to convince their teachers within their school to get the vaccine.
Another question. Parents are used to signing a lot of forms at the beginning of school. Can you put that in there with the
So we make this a very fast process. I mean, we think about from a business model. What we do is we start the process somewhere in mid-October. We give parents typically a packet gets sent home, and each one of those packets has a sticker on them and it has a deadline date on them. And it's usually about a week's time or 5 working days that we say, return the packet by so-and-so date. Every school has a different date. My kids brought it back home. I knew I had to get it in by Monday. I got it in Friday. They get it in Monday, they get the shot the following week. It's a very rapid, moving forward sort of process. Because
it lose probably a lot more.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned with, because there's so much sheer magnitude of sign of papers.
Yeah.
And the parents also, because they're not there, want to know truly what day they get the vaccine. So this short time frame gives them opportunity. You get the consent form, you know within 2 weeks your kid's going to get vaccinated.
It's based on business, some of those business tactics and strategies, the way we do it, rather than trying to, I mean, it would be more convenient for us in the school system, but I think it's more from a sense of let's get these kids and parents, and that's where we hit with the mass media also at the same time. Your packets are coming home, and everything, you know, you turn on your television news, it's on the news, it's in the papers, so parents know this is that time of the year.
But we started getting calls in August.
And then after they sign, the kids then have to bring the consent back to the school?
The parents sign it, put it back, the kids put it back in the packet, send them to school. The
option. Issues with the older kids? Because I'm from the university, we do this out in rural counties in Georgia, and we have an issue with the older kids, you know, stuff gets stuck in the backpack, and they don't find it till May.
I don't know, my 7-year-old did get vaccinated last year because he kept it.
Yeah.
And that's and then that's why we made it available online. So if parents know about it, they can download the forms, actually sign them, send them back,
and
not just depend on kids.
Online. So the parents can actually go in and look and see what day their school is being vaccinated.
And for the I don't know about the smaller kids.
We need to go ahead and close. If you can just hold your question and come on up and ask him, we'll let everyone go. But thank you so much. That was fascinating. Thank you.